Not enough time left in the day. So the strings are rusty, keys melted to gray. On the old piano, nobody can play. The old tombstone covered up with weeds. The old Torah, nobody can read. Religion she still needs. The old tombstone covered up with weeds. The old piano nobody can play. Not enough time left in the day. Rusty, keys melted to gray. On the old piano, nobody can play.
Hello, I'm Lee Robartis. The following is an embellished interview with American avant-garde performer and songwriter Eugene Chadbourne, recorded October 16th, 2010, backstage before a solo concert at the Earshot Jazz Festival in Seattle, Washington.
Songs. I sort of lost track of your stuff for about 10 years, and then I've sort of been rediscovering through the website and so forth. And my favorite stuff, personally, is the protest songs and the political songs. And it seems like you write special types of narrative protest songs, sometimes telling stories about real events. Do you feel you have a role in publicizing or memorializing events in a way that regular journalism has been less successful?
Well, I wouldn't want to cut out regular journalism, because without that, that's where I get a lot of these songs. My favorite kind are the kind you can just write right out of a newspaper clipping, like I Cut the Wrong Man. I don't know if that's necessarily a protest song.
Uh-huh.
It's really a... But I've been thinking more and more about protests. People think about protest songs as being connected to specific political events, like, you know, here's a song about Vietnam, here's a song about racism. But I like the idea of protest songs about behavior and human behavior in general. And that's a really good example of it, because there was this little newspaper clipping that said, man stabbed by accident at church picnic. So, of course, I read it, you know, and it said that this guy, the background of it was this guy had been drugged at a church picnic some 20 years previous to that. Somebody had put something in his communion wine and knocked him out. So right away I was laughing about that. And then the guy went to another, it was a Methodist. He went to another Methodist meeting 20 years later, and he thought he recognized the guy that did it. So he promptly stabbed him, and as the guy was lying on the ground in agony, he goes, oh, I cut the wrong man.
I cut the wrong man, I cut the wrong man. I made a mistake, I won't do it again.
At a Methodist Sunday church picnic, old people were milling around. Jimmy McGriff saw Daniel McCain, and a charge went right through his brain. He remembered a Sunday 10 years ago. They were drinking communion wine. He passed out, the world spinning around. Some joker's idea of a good time. Somebody had drugged the communion Kool-Aid. They laughed in his face when he woke up. Then they chuckled when he staggered. They guffawed when he threw up. He swore one day he'd get even. I know I don't have to explain. He thought, you bastard, your time has come. When he recognized Daniel McCain, McGriff took out his pocket knife, grabbed McCain in a bear hug. He took out that razor sharp knife. He said, you better kiss goodbye to your wife before Daniel had a chance to argue. His throat sliced open wide, blood pouring out everywhere. Not a chance he would survive. Hundreds of Methodists just stood there. Nobody even raised a hand. And that old fool McGriff realized he didn't really even know that man. Here comes the sheriff with his handcuffs. First degree murder charges, goddamn. That's when Jimmy McGriff realized he cut the wrong man. I cut the wrong man, I cut the wrong man. I made a mistake, I won't do it again. Cut the wrong man.
And, you know, when I see something like this, I just think, well, all you have to do is just sort of, you just take the story and line it out there, you know. I cut the wrong man, I cut the wrong man, I made a mistake, I won't do it again.
I was just listening to that song on my car stereo, just coming over here a few minutes.
There's really a lot of them that are like that. People will vote for whoever gives them food. That came right out of a newspaper article. So I think it kind of works in tandem.
I cut the wrong man, I cut the wrong man, I made a mistake, I won't do it again. Cut the wrong man.
Definitely these songs, if they have any kind of longevity to them, which all you need is a few people to own the record and then it sort of lives in time, you know.
Right.
But then it helps memorialize something that happened, definitely. If people listen to the words and are aware of kind of the source of it.
And you ask them all to sink to the bottom. It was really fun.
On the fifth floor of the roofless warehouse, 11 years old, crawling through the rubble, searching for his missing brother. Bewildered like everyone in this freezing town, faces pressed up against the windows of the cafe, wanting to see what the death notices say. They died to eat, they're not criminals. They died for bread, that's not bad or good. And people will vote for whoever gives them food. And fifth day, food failed to arrive. The crowd marched on the depot, demanding supplies. They knew about the food drop made the week before, and only four men there to guard the door. They died to eat, they're not criminals. They died for bread, that's not bad or good. And people will vote for whoever gives them food. Torches have the building burned. The whole crowd came out for the funerals. 15 bodies, 15 lorries. Not enough fuel, so they stacked the bodies five high. No flowers, so a sprig of pine. They died to eat, they're not criminals. They died for bread, that's not bad or good. And people will vote for whoever gives them food. Distribution, and the whole kingdom's theirs. 'Cause people will vote for whoever gives them food.
Thank you.
answered my next question, which was, you know, how much are your political narrative songs based on real events, or do you, you know, take liberties with the stories, for example? Chopping Down Weeds, about the North Carolina dope grower who donates to State Senator Jesse Helms.
That was theorizing. You know, there were a lot of theories about Jesse Helms, but they never really caught him with his pants down, you know.
You've been found guilty of embezzlement.
People disappear on the face of the earth in Guatemala every year.
Union Country Club.
They catch Senator Jordan stealing. Judge gives him a little slap. There's no home for battered children who can pull themselves up by their bootstraps. A new disease sweeps the world, killing young and old, you know. But research is too expensive, so we're just gonna let it go. But if someone smokes some grass before home economics class, now that's a real emergency. Our government gets off its knees, spends money freezingly, fighting the worst enemy. Chopping down weeds.
But despite the state's commitment to marijuana,
no blacks on this beach or on this street, 50 more will die today. Our government applies pressure in subtle and tactful ways. There's no money to clean the rivers or the lakes or the ocean or the sky. Forget about the old folks, or just wait around and they'll die. But if someone rolls a J after a hard working day, now there's a real emergency. Our government gets up off its knees, spends tax dollars free as you please, fighting the worst enemy. Chopping down weeds, put them in a pile, and then lighting them on fire.
But despite the state's commitment to marijuana,
it's an all-out effort, a national disaster. Attorney General Mises working hard. He's hovering in a helicopter right over your front yard. Drop some nuclear waste there, nobody would care, but drop a marijuana seed. And now you're the enemy, spending money free as they please, bringing you down to your knees.
Chopping down weeds,
set them in a pile, and then lighting them on fire. Look at that cop over there in the corner. He's been here all night. He's starting to smile. So when were you first approached by these officials?
Hell, I don't remember.
And what did they ask you at that time?
Well, they said if I had any substandard marijuana fields right now in my bounty of fields, that if I was willing to burn off a few of them for the photography crews, they'd pay me quite handsomely for that, and they'd let me go ahead and harvest the rest of my fields. That is, by providing, of course, I was willing to kick back pretty handsomely there to the state senator, Jesse Helms. But I've been doing that anyway with the moonshine for years, and I think it's really a wonderful arrangement. I like living here in North Carolina.
You know, when somebody is so homophobic, that usually means that's really where they really are a homosexual. When somebody is so anti-pornography and the sex trade, that usually means they're in the thick of it. Just judging from people's behavior, these people are hypocrites. They just don't let, they just can't come out and say, let's just enjoy this stuff. Instead, they have to kind of condemn it. You know, and he was always, he was behind at one point this massive move to eliminate pornography completely from the state of North Carolina. They were putting pressure on every place, you know, 7-Elevens don't have these magazines, you know, blah, 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 blah. And they started going after these places, you know, that show, that have peep shows or show loops. Or, and then one of those, and the problem they had was they couldn't find a jury that was unbiased. Everybody they talked to had had some experience with pornography, so it's just like trying to seat someone with an insurance trial. If you've been in a car accident, they eliminate you. If your mother's been in a car accident, they eliminate you. There's so many reasons. So finally, this judge said, I don't want to hear any more of these cases. What we're doing is taking people that have no interest in pornography and don't like it, and we're forcing them to watch it and decide whether it's obscene or not. And he said, it makes more sense just to let people watch it that like to watch it. What are we doing? So this judge got in a big... But this was just a kind of typical of the kind of stuff that was going on with Helms, you know.
And that probably spurred you to write Women Against Porno.
That was a neighbor that was the daughter of an old woman that lived next door that got me to write that song.
Women Against Pornography.
It's a bunch of guys. Some are invalids, some are lonely. They have sex with their eyes, and now we're all under arrest. I said, please explain, I don't understand how I'm committing a crime against all women in the palm of my hand. Instead I'll hold a picket sign. Women, women against pornography. There's still nuclear weapons, no more Hustler magazine. Pictures of a titty may blow somebody's mind. I gotta go now. Jerry Falwell's calling on my other line.
We got into an argument one night about it, and she said, in this film, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, they dismember women and all this. I said, that's not a porno film. I've got news for you. I said, that's a horror film. I said, we're talking about something completely different.
When she gets undressed, there's inequality in it, and now we gotta sneak around. Cause there's not many movies they still let you see. No more Alfred Hitchcock, no more Fellini. You can still see Meryl Streep, and now women all feel safe.
She came from Minnesota, where this Andrea Dworkin was from, and they attempted to. She wrote this incredible book about pornography brutalizing women and all this kind of stuff. But they tried to ban all this kind of stuff there, and then they ran into a problem with the gay community because the question was, can men still watch male porno? And if so, then how can the male porno not be abusive when the female, so they never could really answer that question. But yeah, that song at one point was so controversial.
Really?
I had a lot of people, like, I had someone threaten to kill me.
Wow.
Yeah, that was an amazing thing, you know. And then it kind of like was no longer so much, you don't hear so much about this right now. It's not a hot issue. They're after Muslims now. They're not really after porno. So then it kind of went to the sidelines. And then every now and then I have some band that just recently, some Italian band I was working with, that were like, we like to play Women Against Pornography. It's a great song. So it gets revived, you know.
What genre are they?
What?
What type of band are they?
They're a Friulian party band. They're from the north of Italy, where they have this dialect, Friulian. It's on near the border of Slovenia. And they've revived all the music in this language. And this is a kind of a really energetic kind of rhythmic band called Arby Garby, with a little horn section. And yeah, they learned a whole bunch of my songs. And I did a record with them last year.
You seem to like a lot of songs exposing the dark side of the drug war. We have a weekly drug war show on our station, a news show from Houston called Cultural Baggage. We got a local show, Marijuana Fact or Fiction, which is basically about the...
Because you got legal medical.
Yeah, but not in Idaho, where our station's a mile across the border. But the guy who does the show comes across the border because that's where he could get medical. Do you think people's perception of the drug war is changing? For example, more people know about the government's role in infesting ghettos with drugs, because you've talked about that a lot in your song.
Do I think the public perception of
them?
I wonder about that. I mean, because what I remember is they kind of revved that up when the war against communism started petering out. because prior to Ronald Reagan, for instance, for many years, like on the New Jersey Turnpike, if they pulled you over and they found some weed, they would just throw it on the ground, tell you to fuck off, unless they had some reason they didn't like you or you had 20 pounds or something.
Yeah.
Back in 1964, I heard a Black Panther shout, "Uncle Sam's in the ghetto, handing heroin out. Opium, drugs are fine, and all the time it'll take revolution off their minds." I've never been to Poland. When I get there, gonna score some Jamaicans sleeping in the town square. We smoke 14 joints a day. A Polish sailor told me the government hands it out. Then we elect solidarity in an ancient Babylon where the hanging gardens grew. The flower tops are mighty fine. You know it's true, it brought mankind such satisfaction. The government just has to have all of the action. The United States must be the high safe way, 'cause you can get it all from the USA. Let's keep the prices high, make it illegal to buy. Since we're neighbors, let's be friends. Let the war on drugs never end.
Then suddenly there was this zero tolerance thing, which, you know, in this is the thing that a lot of police departments and mayors and things in big cities complain about, because it clogs up the legal system, not just in the United States, internationally. Like, I just was playing in England, and the London police chief said that he wanted the law changed. He didn't want any small amounts of drugs. He didn't want these people brought in. Because A, it was clogging up the legal system and keeping the police from doing real work, and also because the penalty far outweighed any harm the person had done. And so, like, someone 15 or 16 years old can have serious problems, like getting a driver's license, getting jobs, getting into various schools, just because of this, which is not such a big deal. I was never so sure how much the public was really into that to begin with. I mean, it was pushed down their throat. It wasn't like an agenda that the government got into because of public outcry or anything like that.
Okay.
They just suddenly immersed themselves in it to the point where, you had Nancy Reagan talking on television for an hour on one Sunday about the Just Say No and all this.
Smashing Russian skulls with axes. Back in Leningrad, a veteran in a brick of hash relaxes. His buddy drops by with the sweet poppy paste. They lost the war the moment they got a taste. Now it's growing on 1990. Black Panthers are gone. Jamaican posse's heading to your town. In our 53rd state, the price of crack so low, they won't have to worry about revolution no more. United States must be the high safe way. You can get it all from the USA. Let's keep the prices high, make it illegal to buy. Since we're neighbors, let's be friends. Let the war on drugs never end.
The idea, say, the CIA crack cocaine connection, you know, if people are more aware of that, you know, the infesting the neighborhoods with drugs, the government actually doing it in certain cases.
I don't know. What do you think? I think most American people don't accept any of these things. They don't want to believe it.
Right.
And they don't want to read about it because it's too complicated. So they kind of pretend it's not happening. all these connections that, like this, that have been going on for years.
But your songs put it right out there.
Well, I mean, I can do whatever I want in my songs.
So what's the story behind Burning Down the Crack District? Remember that song?
That was, there's a lot of songs I've written just based on dreams. And that was a dream I had. And I don't, I'm amazed you even know that song.
Yeah, I got a cassette from you. The one time I wrote you, you sent a bunch of cassettes to me, and that was on it.
Yeah, because I never really did much with that. But it was, and it was also in that dream, this neighborhood near my house, which is just a kind of, you know, a TGIF and Mexican restaurant and this kind of thing, was suddenly like some crack district kind of really run down, and they were burning it down to the ground. Yeah,
it's almost like being attacked by zombies, I remember in the lyrics. Oh, gosh. And let's see.
But I have a lot. That and the newspaper clippings to me are like the best ways to write songs. Sometimes I just dream an entire song and then I can remember it, or a composition of some kind. And I tend to think those ideas that come from dreams are some of the best things, really.
They were burning down the crack district at Holden and Spring Garden. Gone was the Fish and Ribs restaurant with the 2-hour free customer parking. Gone was the Szechuan eatery and the bowling alley. All there was were burning walls and smoking incendiaries. The cops surrounded the intersection at Holden in Spring Garden. I'd been out of town for a week or two. I guess a lot had happened. It used to be so fashionable, a decent place to spend your cash. Now they were torching it down to the ground and looking for places to smash. Away. So I approached a cop. I said, "Sir, is it safe to walk home until the trouble stops?" He said, "Oh, just stroll right on through. This here battle we're winning. We've just about burned down all the buildings and shot all the people in them. First they'd throw firebombs in the windows, and when the blaze had started, they'd stomp down the doors. And through the haze, the machine guns farted. Oh, people stumbling out, some with their hands in the air, some trying to resist. Boxes of handcuffs there to clamp around their wrists."
You know, breaking the law every day, that doesn't necessarily come from a clipping, I suppose. It's not going to be dated soon, because it's just a song, you know, it's going to resonate for a long time. What was the situation?
That's one that gets updated every now and then. Because, like, now there's a verse about the book, what's his name, Blagojevich.
Oh, right.
Good old governor, what's his name?
Yeah.
Just wants a better wage. Yeah, so every now and then that gets updated a little bit. That's an incredibly, for my songs, that's a pretty popular one.
Oh, yeah, I think it really resonates with people.
People really like that.
Yeah, I think you know, it resonates now more than ever because dissent is being criminalized so much in the last 5-10 years.
Well, what I always liked about it there's two things in that. Various people like Ed Meese and now Blagojevich are these people that break a lot of laws in a negative way. That's discussed, as well as our behavior as citizens. We're always breaking laws that we don't think are important, you know, and they're not. So it's like everybody's breaking the law every day, you know, sometimes good and sometimes bad. So you wonder what all these laws are all about. I mean, my favorite, we used to always talk about, it's illegal to dub this movie, you know. Don't make a copy of this movie. The FBI right. will come after it. I mean, are they really going to, you know?
For breakfast, break it again at lunch. Now some friends are coming over to break the law a bunch. No matter what they say, we'll break the law every day. Breaking the law every day. Popping a little pill. So he won't feel the pain inside a Nazi brain. He just can't wait to rule where it's legal to put your tool. He'll get his way. We'll break his laws every day. Breaking the law every day. Slopping a pail in a federal jail. Instead he gets paid to break the law every day. Breaking the law every day. Breaking the law every day. No killer ain't worth locking up. Rapist with a knife. Just give me a teenager buying beer for his wife. The state can keep the pregnant daughters. We'll send the sons to Nicaragua. You better pray we keep breaking the law every day. We're breaking the law every day. That's what we're doing. Breaking the law every day.
Little tags on the under the sofa. Remove under penalty.
Oh yeah, yeah. I removed some of them.
Don't break the law.
Yeah, I was in. I'm staying in West Seattle, and they have a sign that says a cruising ordinance along the waterfront there. And I, what, am I cruising? I went back and forth twice.
For gay cruising? For, like, people picking each other up?
It doesn't say. You know, it just says anti-cruising ordinance.
Because, like, some of the cities, like, well, the thing I remember about Great Falls as a teenager was all anybody ever did was cruise. They just drove up and down the fucking street all the time. And then they have this in High Point, North Carolina. And they came out with an anti-cruising ordinance. And they had police posted at various places to watch the cars and see who was doing what. And I thought, this is the most ridiculous thing. I mean, if teenagers want to bore themselves driving up and down the street, you're going to make that illegal now.
Waste of gas, right. I just want to ask a few more. I hope you're doing okay, because I think this is wonderful. So you've done a lot of covers from so many genres. Do you have a huge record collection?
I mean, it's not ridiculously huge. I'd say it's average for someone like me.
Right.
About half of it belonged to my wife when I married her. She had a lot of bluegrass and stuff like that. So we kind of complimented each other.
Yeah.
in a small cabaret in a Texas border town lived a boy who played guitar. People came from miles around, and all the girls were hawking their jewelry
to get enough of money in their purse to take a trip on the Greyhound bus to
hear him play. Could not rhyme or reason if the little fellow never made a dime. Give him an old guitar, he'd be happy all the time. And all the girls from 9 to 90
were just hypnotized and just fascinated and just begging him not to stop when he did play.
Forgot about that boy in that Texas border town.
And then one day, yeah, sure, on the hit parade, you heard the sound of the little boy, the Tennessee flat top box he could play.
Classics, that's what I would call them. Do you have like a criteria for choosing covers? Is that one of those?
I'm kind of trying to get out of it. I'm only doing a little bit of it now for several reasons, and one was that it was ridiculous to keep up with it. Yeah. It's from the point of view, like with my own songs, hopefully if somebody requests one, I can play it. Now, if you wanted to hear Burning Down the Crack District, I couldn't play it because I don't remember it. I haven't been able to find the words written down anywhere. So, you know. But I've been going through a process of making sure I know how to play a lot of my own songs, and the majority of the concert playing time is I do those. I still do a few covers. That was definitely one of the things I like to do, was find songs that people really didn't know very well, and bring them out, or songwriters I thought were underexposed. And one of the problems you get into is that. Some of these people are so brilliant, you just feel like you could play every song they ever recorded, like Nick Drake, for instance.
Right.
And then it's like, well, people don't come to me to hear a Nick Drake revival, you know, so I have to no matter how much I want to, I can't go in that direction. I have to kind of, you know, narrow it down. Thank you.
I live by the river. I hide my house away, just like the river. I can change my ways.
But one thing that a friend of mine, and a French guitar player, he came out with a project doing Kylie Minogue songs. And that was really, at that point I thought, well, whatever I've got going with all these cover versions and doing these readaptations of them and bringing them into other genres, it's just like, when I started doing that, people really didn't understand what the hell I was doing, you know. And now it's like full steam ahead. A lot of people are doing that. I don't really have to even focus on it very much anymore. So.
Yeah, I remember there's the Eddie Chatterbox double trio love. Yeah, a side of it is just great.
Yeah, that's another guy, you know.
It's the truth of life. Changes in between. Those lost moments we still keep our life alive. I cried so hard after all the pain. Time will fade.
Tell me about the changes on your website and how you're rethinking the way of marketing your careers. How do you pronounce that? Uber? Your careers in music?
Yeah, well, it looked like, I don't know when I wrote that latest thing, maybe about a year ago, I can't remember. But it's been interesting, there's been absolutely no reaction. One person said to me, I would buy some memory sticks. But nobody seems the slightest bit interested. I really don't think it's going in that direction. It's not for some reason, it's like not a desirable object to have or something. I don't know. Uh-huh. People are still buying CDs from me, so.
Okay. So.
I'm kind of hanging in there with that for now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know. Yeah, but you've cut down on the.
The thing that really didn't appeal to me about these new changes is they all involve using the computer, and I'm so sick of computers.
I understand.
And the more things that you have to use a computer to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, now you have to book travel, you have to use a computer. That I used to do that on the phone with this nice travel agent in L.A.
Yeah. Walk down.
Very pleasant. Then he would call me back and make jokes about where I was going and have all kinds of good ideas. Now I have to do that myself. You know, it's obnoxious. And there's just more and more things like that. So, yeah, I had just no idea what's going to happen with any of that at all. But I wrote that to sort of see what kind of reaction I would get. And it certainly didn't stimulate much of a reaction at all.
Well, maybe just people love your packaging.
Well, people do like a homemade package.
So now you're down to maybe one or two releases per year featured. Are those what you consider the best choices for consumers who are maybe unfamiliar with that part of your career?
Well, I'm still playing with this idea that some CDs come out kind of as temporary releases, but the people that collect my stuff, they fight me on this. They keep asking for these things, like years later, which sometimes, for example, if I'm working on a studio project with somebody and they have some rough mixes done, that might be the kind of thing that might be on one of these CDs that I regard as not a permanent, I just regard it as something that will be available for a short time so I can get some feedback from people about the music. And but they don't really let me get away with that. Once something exists, sooner or later someone asks for it again, you know. And so I just keep all the material, so I can just, some of the things I only sell one or two copies of a year.
Uh-huh. You just dub them or burn them special for when the order comes in?
Yeah. I pretty much do everything like that, except the stuff that's really selling, then I make, you know, 40 or 50 at a time or something like that.
It's
a small scale kind of thing.
Yeah. What do you think the role of community radio has been in spreading your career output, your Does that still work for you?
You mean, and also student radio?
Yeah, also.
Yeah, I think that's always been really important, because that's the only radio exposure I have.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I had this great conversation with this top 40 DJ in Greensboro. I met him at a party. He goes, "Oh, Eugene Chadbourne, you're a genius. If there's ever anything I can do for you," I said, "Well, why don't you play one of my songs?"
I can't do that.
What about get the guy who's on at 4 a.m. to do it?
You can't do that.
What about half the song? I finally got this guy down. I said, "Look, this record, this one song starts off with this drum beat. Just play the one sound." And he couldn't, you know, "I can't do that. I don't have control over that. We have a very specific list of things we can play." You know, and a lot of people feel that not only my music, but there's a lot of other music that would have a much wider following if people were just exposed to it. Because you have a lot of people that dig up music, and they look for things to be interested in, and they read about it, and they find it, and whatever. And it's easier than ever now with the internet.
Yeah.
If somebody says Townes Van Zandt to you, you can be listening to the whole evening. Just do a little Googling, and there you go. But still, there's loads of people that would probably like this kind of thing, you know, not only me, but a lot of other stuff, if they just had a chance to hear it.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know to what extent people listen to the radio anymore. I'm completely out of touch with that.
We're trying hard.
We certainly listened to it when I was a kid, the top 40 radio, all the time. And then when I was driving my own kids around, they listened to it some.
Yeah.
But it wasn't like they could ever tell you what the number one song was. That sort of has gone. They don't seem to do that much anymore.
Yeah, maybe that's good.
They had this countdown every week, I remember, in Denver on KIMN, mm-hmm. starting with number 50, and they would go all the way up to number one.
Oh, yeah.
It used to be kind of fun if you liked a song to see what was going to happen with it, or other songs. Like, I remember this song by the Rolling Stones called Dandelion. I thought it was just great. It was so weird. You know, it never got past about 30, which for the Stones was like a real slap in the face.
Right.
So I sort of used to enjoy that. But it's crazy. Like, you can hear, like in Greensboro, you can hear my music on the student radio.
Mm-hmm.
The public radio, never.
No.
They never play my music. And you know, this whole thing with public radio being accused of being so left-wing and everything.
Yeah. I heard you once.
They won't play my political stuff.
Right.
They won't go near it. The one record, one record of mine they reviewed, it was a jazz record. Instrumental.
I actually heard one of your songs on one of those NPR weekend programs. It might have been early This American Life, and it wasn't a political song, but they had you on just for about 2 minutes or so.
I think probably in some cities like San Francisco or Portland or maybe Seattle, it's better, you know, for something like that. But
I would say in Moscow, there's probably 12 active DJs between...
Moscow, Idaho.
Between the... Yeah.
I just wanted to see, do you want to be taken for food or have somebody bring you food before?
No, I'm cool here with this stuff.
Okay, just want to make sure you're okay. So
I'm fine.
Thanks.
There's probably a dozen DJs who are active there, either on the community station, which I run, or the college station, who at least occasionally play Eugene Chadbourne. You're known, but it's mainly for the older stuff. We haven't caught up with the last decade or so. Except for maybe a little bit of you and Jimmy Carl Black. I've heard Trapped in a Dutch Coffee Shop and things like that. Okay, so we have the rake, the birdcage, and the plunger. Have you invented anything new since those?
No, I haven't really been doing much with those, but... there were a bunch of other ones too. My favorite one was the electric toastar, like a toaster, but like a sitar, which was like it was like a toaster with a neck on it, with a banjo neck on it and strings. You could play it, and it was actually quite musical, and you could make toast for people in the audience at the same time, which was fun.
I
really haven't been doing that much of that kind of thing lately.
Yeah, it sounds like it would be an interesting sound. Is it on some of your regularly distributed albums?
I'm not sure right now, no.
Okay. So has your musical output slowed down? You know, you're one of the most prolific songwriters on the planet, probably, I would think.
I don't know about that. I'm trying to focus on making one or two really recordings in my studio that I'm really happy with every year. And then various things get recorded traveling or in friends' studios. And I've been doing a lot of new vinyl stuff lately. for in various, not in the States, but in other countries. You know, so that seems to be coming back. A lot of people are interested in producing vinyl.
You have a few highly prized vinyl copies of your album. I think Eugene von Beethoven. It's just beautiful artwork and so forth. So how would you describe your tours these days? You know, where do you go? Who do you play with?
Well, I'm still playing a lot solo. As you probably know, Jimmy died, so
yeah.
That was the end of that great partnership. I haven't really... There's no way to replace him,
yeah.
But I've been trying out different drummers to see if I can find someone else to work with. I just did a tour in England with Roger Turner, who's a really great drummer. That was really fun. But, you know, there's no Jimmy Carl Black.
Dropped another needle. Everybody's talking all at once. Everybody stood there on a bridge. Everybody used to meet in the park. Now they've stopped making political speeches. Now they've dropped all the stuff for shooting up. Dropped another needle since 6 o'clock.
I don't know, I'm kind of winding down. I'd like to, in the next few years, retire from touring as much. I'm not doing it as much even now, you know.
Yeah, I noticed that it's like, is this maybe the first time in 10 years you've been around here?
I was here, like, they were talking about it, I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago, at Polestar.
Okay.
Yeah.
Evan Johns, he was a great collaborator with you. I've really enjoyed at least the two albums I know about. You in touch with him? You working?
In pretty bad health, apparently. No, I'd like to be more in touch with him, but because of this kind of alcoholic delirium, he thinks for some reason I ripped him off or something. So he's been really mean. He sends me really mean emails and things. It's because he's in a kind of a delirium.
Right. Well, I guess I'm winding down. If there's anything you want to say beyond that, beyond what I've asked.
Well, let's get me to Idaho. I don't want to. I like to get there sometime.
Okay, well, we'll check in with you when we come. I'll give you my card here.
Yeah. Now they've dropped the entire argument. Now they've dropped all the stuff for shooting up.
You've been listening to an embellished interview with the maverick, outspoken American avant-garde performer and songwriter, Eugene Chadbourne, recorded October 16th, 2010, backstage before a solo concert at the Earshot Jazz Festival in Seattle, Washington. This has been a production of Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. Check it out.